Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo, the Royal Historical Society, and I'm a host on the channel. And today I am pleased to have with us Roland Phillips. Mr. Phillips is a publisher at the August and Venerable Publishing House, John Murray. He is a graduate of Cambridge University, and today we are speaking about his book, A Spy Named Orphan, The Enigma of Donald MacLean. Welcome, Mr. Phillips.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Mr. Phillips, what is the primary thesis of your book?
The primary thesis of my book is just how important a spy Donald MacLean was. He was one of the Cambridge spies recruited in the 1930s, and he remained a spy until his defection to Moscow in May 1951. But until some papers were declassified 2 years ago, and until I saw some family papers of the MacLean family, I don't think anyone understood quite how important he was, and what is more, quite how serious it was that we failed to catch him in time when we knew perfectly well that both we and the Americans that there'd been a spy of that magnitude in the British Foreign Office.
Now, Sir Roger Makins, later Lord Sherfield, who has a walk-in part in the story, was your grandfather. Can you tell the audience a little bit about him?
He was a senior diplomat. He ended his career as British ambassador in Washington. But in the 40s and 50s, he was Donald MacLean's boss. He first came across MacLean in 1946-7, when they were the only two British diplomats on a highly secret committee in Washington, the Atomic Energy Commission, where they worked with the Secretary of State and senior military figures, and that decided Allied nuclear policy post-war. Then he was his boss in London at the time of his defection. Roger Makins gave Donald MacLean's last job, which was head of the American Department, just at the beginning of the Korean War, and was widely blamed. He did know he was the spy they'd been looking for all these years just before the defection, but was told that MacLean was being followed by the Secret Service, which indeed he was, and that he, Makins, was to act as normal. However, he wasn't told that MacLean wasn't followed in the evenings and at weekends. So when MacLean asked for the next following day off work, Roger Makins acted as normal and said, yes, of course. And that was the day he defected. So when I used to talk to my grandfather about MacLean, he was always pretty irritated at being blamed for MacLean's defection, when in fact he'd only been following his own instructions.
Can you give the audience some idea of Donald MacLean's family background and especially the character and career of his father, Sir Donald MacLean?
Absolutely. So one of the theses of my book is the what would now seem insane trust that the establishment put into those they saw as similar to them. And they saw Donald MacLean as very similar to them. He'd been to a top school. He'd been to Cambridge University. And in the interview for the Foreign Office, simply a couple of character references were all that were needed. There was no vetting at all. If they had vetted him, they first of all would have seen quite how outspokenly communist he'd been in his university days, but also they would have might have thought, well, this man who passes for one of us, he was always beautifully dressed, he was very good looking, very tall, very patrician looking. In fact, his father had been born into very, very humble circumstances. His father was a shoemaker and crofter who lost his home in the far islands of Scotland and ended up in South Wales, but who made a considerable name for himself as a strong Presbyterian throughout his life, Sir Donald MacLean, which he became, and we'll call him to distinguish him from his son, and moved to South Wales as a solicitor, never went to university, went to a free school, never went to university, and there worked for good works as well as being a solicitor. He was chairman of the local temperance movements. He founded a remarkable charity, which is still going today, against cruelty to children, where he was spotted by the leader of the Liberal Party in the House of Parliament, who persuaded him to become an MP. So he ended up as Minister of Education. So he had humble origins, he had a remarkable career. He insisted on family prayers twice a day. He wouldn't allow alcohol or tobacco in his house. And above all, he instilled in his children the need to follow their conscience. Just he didn't quite mean it as his middle and most brilliant son did, which was follow a political conscience. He meant a conscience towards God. So I believe that Sir Donald Woods and MacLean's upbringing was a massive influence on his communism and a reason why it wasn't spotted, that he might have felt some class resentfulness in the class-ridden world in which he moved.
How did MacLean's years at his public school, Gresham's, influence, if at all, his future beliefs and his character and career as a spy?
I think they played a very large part alongside his upbringing, which I've just described. Gresham's was a very liberal school. It encouraged freedom of thought and debate when the private schools of Britain didn't necessarily do that. They were still really working for their pupils to go out and run the empire. But Gresham's instilled more of a public service factor. It had a very strange disciplinary code, which any pupil would want to keep buried. And I think it's important to remember, too, that as just described, MacLean was the first one of his family who was going to go to university, who was at a fee-paying school. He was a brilliant schoolboy. And I think he learned at that school both to further enhance his deeply held beliefs about, in this case, equality and peace, and also to keep that hidden and be outwardly a success, which he was a successful schoolboy, and he was a very, very successful diplomat. I believe at that school, at Gresham's, he was able to learn to live a double life successfully.
Can you discuss the atmosphere, political and social, at Cambridge in 1933 when MacLean went up there?
Yes, it was very febrile. It was Hitler had come to power the year before, so there were the first rumblings of fascism on the continent. The Depression was on. There were a lot of Britain was riven by poverty. Parts of Britain was riven by poverty, not necessarily the people at Cambridge, but there were, while Maclean was there, the hunger marches when the starving of the north of England marched on London to show the capital their plight. And there was a general feeling that the generation that had led the country into the First World War and the terrible slaughter that ensued still weren't getting it right. So the communism was very, what was just starting up at Cambridge. The first communist cell was formed in Maclean's first year, but the Socialist Society, of which Maclean was a member from early on, was a very vibrant and most people of conscience and feeling were communist at that time, because the alternative was really shocking. And communism was the party of peace at that point. It wasn't known. Stalin's worst atrocities weren't known. And it seemed pretty ideal, the notion of equality. So it was a political hothouse, and one that Maclean dove into.
When exactly did Maclean become a communist?
He didn't join the party until he was in Moscow, but he became a communist. He started attending meetings in his first year at Cambridge, but he became an outspoken communist. His father died at the end of Maclean's first year at Cambridge, after which he became unshackled, really, and became wrote radical communist poetry in the college magazine. He was known as Maclennan in various other publications. He wrote book reviews of very left-wing case. So he became communist as soon as he got to Cambridge, but he became an outspoken one in his second year and third year.
Who was Arnold Deutsch?
Arnold Deutsch was a remarkable man. So at Cambridge, Maclean met Kim Philby. And Philby was a year ahead of him at Cambridge and had left and had married, had been to Vienna. He'd taken part in anti-fascist riots and married a Viennese communist who was a friend of Arnold Deutsch. When Maclean left Cambridge, he was planning to go to Russia to teach English. And Philby asked him to supper just after he left and said to him, if you could do a lot more good for the cause than by going to Russia, if you were to follow your parents' plan for you, you're brilliant, and go into the Foreign Office as you originally planned. And if you are inclined to do that, I think you should meet a friend of my wife's, Arnold Deutsch. Deutsch was a Viennese communist who'd worked in Vienna. He was very brilliant. He got a early doctorate in at the age of only 25 in chemistry. But always studied psychology on the side. And after he left Vienna University, he worked with Wilhelm Reich, who was a disciple of Freud's. So he was right in the psychological world. And he ran a publishing house called Münster Verlag that published material for what was known as the Sex Poll organization, which was Reich's organization, which stated that you couldn't be politically liberated unless you were sexually liberated. So Reich was known as the prophet of the better orgasm. And not surprisingly, perhaps, Deutsch quite soon found himself in trouble with the Viennese police as a pornographer, and came to London as a student of psychology. But also he was recruiting for Moscow Center. And he brilliantly, I think, realized that this was the only moment so far, and indeed the only moment afterwards, where you could recruit people on purely ideological grounds because of what I was saying about what's happening elsewhere in the world. And further, he thought that if he could recruit the best young people straight out of university, any communism they displayed at university could be put down to the foolishness of youth, and they would also stand a very good chance of getting to the top in the professions that ran British life. And so Deutsch was the recruiter for all of the Cambridge Five, and as soon as Maclean met him, he was deeply charismatic, Deutsch, and Maclean leapt at the chance to work for him.
You say on page 56 that Maclean's relatively humble family background and the lack of private means made him in his own mind, as compared to his friends and acquaintances at Cambridge, déclassé. Would this be an additional reason for his spying career?
Yes, I think there was an element of resentment about not having private income, which became more noticeable when he was in the Foreign Office, particularly when he was serving in Paris at the beginning of the war, because at that point, everyone in the Foreign Office, all his contemporaries, did have private incomes, were expected to entertain on them, and it was very much a part of the life of the well-born diplomats. So I think that was always a niggle for Maclean, yes.
Just to go back to the question of vetting for candidates for the diplomatic service, in the case of Philby, he was essentially blocked because of his communist past at Cambridge.
Yes.
By the committee, or at least one member of the committee.
Yes. Philby's references. So you had to have references from your school and university. And Philby's reference did make much of his communism at Cambridge, whereas Maclean's, and I don't know whether it's because he asked it not to, his tutor did not make any reference to his political activities at Cambridge. So he was asked, but however, they had it was not unknown that he'd been very political, and he was asked in his interview for the Foreign Office. One of the interviewers said, "We note you are very left-wing at Cambridge. Are you still?" To which Maclean gave the entirely truthful answer, "I'm working on it." Mm-hmm. So, and that was enough. They didn't investigate further. That was enough.
So in essence, like a lot of things in British or, in fact, even American life, public life at the time, it was a little bit haphazard, not entirely bureaucratized and routinized process.
Absolutely. In fact, there was no positive vetting until after, a direct result of Maclean's defection was positive vetting in the Foreign Office. There was none until then. They didn't even have a head of security until the Second World War, when they thought we better have one. So when in Maclean's early days, he was able to take any document he wished out in his briefcase, nobody checked, nobody did anything. So it was a society run on trust.
So that was the case in terms of not having a security apparatus set up at the Foreign Office, even after the exposure of Mr. King?
Absolutely right, yes. And it's why we'll come on to when it was realized there had been a spy in the Foreign Office, it was why they simply never looked at Maclean, or indeed any senior diplomats. They looked at foreign workers, they looked at secretaries, but they naturally assumed that none of their own class could possibly be spies.
Can you explain why Maclean did not give up spying for Moscow after he heard about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939?
Yes, that is a very good question, because a lot of British communists did give up. That was Moscow was in bed with the enemy, and besides, patriotism then trumped ideology. I always feel in Maclean's case, he was able to hold patriotism and ideology alongside each other. And in that particular instance, that was the first point I realized that his communism was of such a ideological or theoretically based communism, because of course by then he also knew, and a lot of communists had given up communism, about Stalin's purges and the horrors perpetrated in the name of communism. Yet he stuck to it because he genuinely believed throughout his life that it was the way to a better world, and above all a peaceful world, he believed. But it was done on such a theoretical level that he was able to discount these things that were happening all around him and that he was hearing about from the Soviet Union. And to the extent that he hated spying. He likened it to being like a lavatory attendant, a filthy job, but someone has to do it, he said. But yet he kept doing it because he believed so firmly in the theory of what he was doing. So that was why he didn't give up at that point.
You state on page 103, in reference to the Russo-Finnish War, that based upon a tip from MacLean about potential Anglo-French military intervention on the side of the Finns, that Stalin decided to, quote, withdraw Russian troops from Finland, unquote. I presume what you mean, in fact, is that Stalin decided at that point to negotiate a relatively soft peace with the Finns rather than a harsh one in order to prevent the British and the French from intervening on the Finn side.
But yes.
Doesn't that raise the question of how much or to what extent the information that MacLean and later on other spies of the Fabulous Five being MacLean, Philby, Burgess, Blunt, and Karen Cross. Mm-hmm. How do we know, or is there any way of ascertaining in terms, or have you discovered in your research for the book, what was the process, or even to the extent that Stalin was taking in and acting upon the information he was getting from these spies, as well as, of course, other spies in the, you know, other parts in Western country, Nazi Germany, etc. In terms of the historical literature, there's sort of some historians say that he was. Others, like Vladislav Zubok, state that, quote, we also do not know how Stalin reacted to the analytical intelligence feedback, unquote, that MacLean and other spies are giving him. So did you or you were able to actually come up with anything empirical and concrete in that area?
There are very few instances, but the short answer is no, because the KGB files, which were briefly open in the early 1990s, are very much closed now. So short of being able to look at the, I gather, volumes and volumes of MacLean material in there, I can't say anything definitive. There are certainly moments when the Russians are able to display knowledge of events and telegrams in the after the war, to do with the Dardanelles, for example, that quite clearly, and that example, without going into detail, was MacLean was one of a very, very select number of people who saw the minutes of that, of an important meeting in Washington. And yet when the American ambassador confronted the Russian foreign minister about it, he was amazed that the Russian foreign minister knew such detail. So there are moments like that that one can say it's more than likely that MacLean's work had changed events. But on the whole, it's more guesswork than that. It's not possible to be historically exact without looking at the KGB files, which I would love to do.
Of course. Can you describe McLean's wife, how they met, her character, and her part in the story of McLean's career as a spy?
Yes. And Melinda Marling, she was called. She was American. She came from a well-off East Coast family, but a very broken home. She moved around a lot as a child. They lived in Switzerland for a time. She was in Paris. She wasn't great at school and left school young, went to Paris with her sister in 1938 to study at the Sorbonne. And I think one of the keys to Melinda's character, and she played a very important role in McLean's life, espionage life, as well as obviously his other life, is that she loved danger. And it struck me first that the American embassy had told all its citizens to leave France as the war became inevitable through 1939. And Melinda's sister had indeed left Paris and gone back to America. Melinda stayed on and on till long after the war started. They met in November 1939. And she was not at all a political person herself. She was never heard to express a political opinion. Donald McLean fell madly in love with her. They met in a cafe on the left bank, the sort of artist bohemian quarter of Paris to which they're both drawn. And he fell madly in love with her, and she didn't want anything to do with this stuffed shirt, very English diplomat, so he took the remarkable risk of telling her he was a Soviet agent, at which point they got together and started their love affair. And that was a remarkable risk for him to take, but it did the trick. And I think that their early married life, she wouldn't marry him until... the only black mark in McLean's Foreign Office file is that he wasn't on hand to evacuate the embassy in June 1940, when the Germans were 3 days away from marching into Paris, because he was off getting married to Melinda. They just made it out of France on the last boat from Bordeaux after the fall of France. Generally, I mean, it was an extraordinary series of risks, unnecessary risks they took, which I think meant she was excited by the danger. And that would also explain the fact that she knew why she stuck to him. I'm sure we'll talk in a minute about his appalling behavior shortly before his defection, and that's why she explains to me why she stuck to him. And I found some family papers in the McLean family that make it quite clear she knew throughout about his espionage and knew about the plans for his defection.
Do you think she would have married him if she had not been at that point in time with child?
I think she would have done, yes. They lost that child. Oh, the child was stillborn. But I think she would have done, yes. And indeed, she had to, because otherwise she would have been stuck in France. The only way she could get out on a British warship was being married to a Brit.
Can you relate what were McLean's duties in Washington, D.C. as second secretary at the British Embassy, and how successful he was in providing information to Moscow?
Yes, this was his prime period of diplomacy, of espionage, and diplomacy to an extent. He went as second secretary, and he had access to all the chancery, which is the sort of engine room of a embassy, documents. He saw everything that came in and out of the embassy, and he went there in June 44, which was just at the point when the the conferences, Potsdam, Yalta, Tehran, particularly Potsdam and Yalta, that settled the shape of Europe, but and the conferences headed by the Prime Minister and the President and Stalin, that settled the shape of Europe were being planned. And we know from tiny snippets that have been decoded of the telegraph traffic to Moscow that he gave away all the telegrams between Churchill and Roosevelt discussing their policy positions on those for those conferences. For example, when they were discussing the borders of Poland, they give their sort of hold line and say that if we will not, we will move from this if Molotov, the Russian foreign minister, is adamant. So Moscow and Molotov knew if he was adamant that he would get a lot more out of the negotiation. So that was the end of the war, his primary and perhaps most devastating espionage. And then post-war, he was on this Atomic Energy Commission, which meant he was, MacLean's special role on it was to handle the Belgian government, who, because of the Congo being a formerly colonial power of theirs, territory of theirs, which is where the uranium was mined. So MacLean's primary role was to negotiate the uranium that went to America, and therefore he could know, or the Russians could know, exactly how much uranium was coming in and therefore how many bombs the Americans were capable of making, which I believe gave Stalin the confidence that, and the number of bombs was far, far smaller than the Americans were publicly claiming. And I believe that gave Stalin the confidence to accelerate his own atom program to the point where he was able to test his bomb 2 years ahead of anyone's estimates.
How important, if at all, was MacLean's information in terms of that Russian development of atom bomb important?
Well, again, it's unquantifiable, but I think, which is why I'm quite careful to say, I believe it helped give Stalin confidence. But I think that it was nonetheless as a regard of the Allied capabilities, it was pretty useful.
So it was useful and important information, but of a different vein than, say, the type of information that Klaus Fuchs was providing.
Yes, because Fuchs was giving away the actual technical know-how. MacLean was giving away more politically and diplomatically sensitive information rather than the technology.
Can you explain what was the Venona code-breaking operation and why it took so long to positively identify MacLean as the spy in the British embassy?
Yes, and this is the sort of crux of the second half of my book. So by law, every telegram leaving the United States and going to Russia, a copy had to be lodged at the one of the three telegraph offices, cable and wireless and so on. And after the war, this meant there were hundreds of thousands of telegrams, all in code, all, it was believed, produced under the one-time pad system by which the code changed each time a document was coded. So it was thought that probably would be a fairly hopeless task to try and look at these. In 1946, it was decided that these had better be looked at. It was expected that it would be largely trade and shipping information. At which point a brilliant man called Meredith Gardner enters the story. Gardner was a remarkable linguist and a brilliant man. He, in the war, he'd been teaching at the University of Ohio when he was taken into the signals code-breaking department, what became the NSA. And he was, for example, was so appalled at how slowly the Japanese material was being decoded in the war that he taught himself Japanese in 3 months in order to help out here. So Meredith Gardner realized, with the help of some early computing power, that some of the one-time pads had been used twice, particularly around 1941 when the Soviets were invaded and had to join the war earlier than they would have liked. They obviously hadn't been able to produce enough pads. So into this chink, Gardner began his work. Quite soon it was it's such difficult work that if I say by 1980, when Venona, which was the operation, was wound up, they'd only decoded 15% of this material. You'll see how hard it was. But quite early on, in 1947, they realized that that some of this material had Foreign Office serial numbers on. In fact, it was the documents, the telegrams I was talking about to do with the Potsdam Conference. And therefore, there'd been a spy in the Washington Embassy. It took them 3.5 years to identify that that spy was McLean, because, first of all, the head of security at the Foreign Office, for there was such a post by then, there's a memo on file saying it won't be a senior man. We must look at any secretaries who had a nervous breakdown around that time. So they thought it could be any one of 6,000 people who've passed through the embassy, and refused to look at the senior people. And indeed, to start with, only looked at casual worker. I mean, outside workers. They refused to look at any Brit, because no Brit could possibly be a spy. And it wasn't until some 18 months later that they decoded, they found another tiny fragment of code that they decoded, where it says Homer, for such was the code name of McLean at that time. Homer thinks we ought to, and then there's something about Greece. They saw the telegram was about Greece. So at that point they realized that that it was someone who was listened to, who had opinions on foreign policy and so on, at which point they raised their sights to look at more senior people. But McLean's great break at that point, he knew none of this, was that they sent as head of station in Washington, in the British Embassy in Washington, they sent Kim Philby. So Philby took one look at, as he put it, the diplomatic list and knew exactly who the spy was, the man he'd recruited, and asked Moscow Station for instructions. And Moscow Station said, well, we want him in place as long as possible, but he has to be got out before he's caught. And then there ensues a sort of farce of British trust and old school network and things, where McLean's name keeps coming up into the frame, and they keep saying, no, it can't be him. They're not aware at this point. He's based in Cairo from 1948-50, where he is a spectacular drunk. He has had a fight with another diplomat, which involved breaking the diplomat's leg. He has trashed the American ambassador's secretary's apartment, and broken her bath in two and thrown all her underwear around out of the window. And he's been found wandering in the Cairo park in the middle of the night in blackout. So this extraordinary behaviour is going on, yet he's still showing up for work. He's still their man. So every time the spotlight comes on to McLean, it then moves away again because they say it simply can't be him. The Americans, the Venona team and the FBI liaison with Venona cannot believe the lackadaisical way in which this investigation is being taken, because it's a very, very serious charge. And don't forget, Venona has already uncovered Klaus Fuchs at Los Alamos and other Los Alamos spies, and shortly is going to uncover the Rosenbergs. So it's really, the investigation goes on for 3 years, and it's really, it's extraordinary. It was extraordinary to read in the files the way people kept saying it can't be McLean. He'd been given away in all but name by a Russian defector in 1939, had said there's a spy in the Foreign Office, he's got a Scottish name, he's under 30. I mean, he'd given away sort of a lot of detail that should have pointed to McLean, but because he was such a gifted diplomat, nobody could believe it. And in the end, the final bit of evidence that Venona uncovered was when Gardner decoded a few words from when McLean's first arrival in New York, before his handler had caught up with him from London, and he'd had a younger, untried someone in the Soviet consulate in New York had sent a telegram saying Homer will be coming to Tyre, which is what they called New York. Washington was Carthage, New York was Tyre, frequently to visit his pregnant wife. And Melinda was pregnant at that time. That was the only clue that got them to McLean.
One of the suspects before McLean was finally pinpointed as the spy was Paul Gore Booth, later on, of course, head of the Foreign Office, Sir Paul Gore Booth, and later Lord Paul Gore Booth. Was he ever notified about the, subsequently, of course, that he was a suspect?
I don't believe so. I'm sure he went to his grave not knowing that he was a suspect. Indeed, you're right. The head of security in the Washington embassy, when they brought this evidence in from 1940, that Philby had alerted them to try and keep control of the situation, the head of security decided it was Gore Booth, on the grounds that Homer was a classical code name, and Gore Booth had given a speech in Latin of such brilliance in his Latin ability that therefore it was Gore Booth. I mean, it's the stuff of comedy, some of that. But no, I don't believe Paul Gore Booth had a clue.
What was the exact cause of McLean's breakdown in Egypt in 1949, where he was the head of chancery?
It was it was alcoholism. It was, I believe, as the Cold War got chillier and he was in Washington at the beginning of the Berlin airlift and those really frightening moments, he began to feel the divide between, as I said, he was a star diplomat, and he believed in Britain, but also he believed in the communist ideology. So his patriotism and his ideology were starting to tear him apart. He also was based in Cairo, which was the first time he'd seen real poverty close up, which he believed communism was the cure of. And also he was being asked to maintain the British government's support of the massively corrupt King Farouk. He'd already been, in his last days in Washington, been noted at dinner parties by friends run by his employers that he'd got more and more anti-capitalist. And I think all those factors, and he used to trash his American hosts at dinner parties, I believe those factors were what tipped him over into his severe alcoholism. And as I say, he did these terrible things to other people and to the secretary's flat, and was found wandering in blackout. So I think it was the increasing Cold War plus his situation, what he saw politically. I think just he couldn't bear it.
Why was McLean not sacked after his behavior in Egypt?
Because it wasn't, it was, they didn't know what had happened. So he after the day after this flat trashing expedition, Melinda, his wife, went to the ambassador and said, Donald's having a nervous breakdown. I think he needs to go home for treatment. And the ambassador, who hated what he called tittle-tattle about so able an officer, said yes, of course. So McLean went home and was given 6 months off work, but none of the bad behavior made it onto his file. In fact, his second-in-command at the embassy wrote a letter to a friend at the embassy, which is on file, blaming Melinda for what had gone on, saying, you know how these Americans like to hit it up a lot. And so because he was untouchable, and it didn't make it onto his file. Even when he was back at work after this sick leave, he got very, very drunk at a party in London and shouted across the room, what would you say if I told you I was a communist, have been all my life? And a secretary in the Foreign Office overheard that and thought she ought to report it back. And there's a handwritten note from the head of personnel on McLean's file recounting this, and it just says, Donald up to his old tricks again. So they just, you know, they let it go every time.
That was that memo was by George Middleton?
The last memo I've mentioned was by Robin Hooper. George Middleton was the person who welcomed McLean back 6 months earlier, and with whom he'd served. And it was very clubby, the Foreign Office in those days. Middleton and McLean had served together in Washington and Paris, I think. And they were old friends. And Middleton, who was then head of personnel, just said, what can we do for you? You know, took him out to lunch, said, do whatever you needs doing. It was, you know, extraordinary to read now.
Why did your grandfather, but obviously not only him, Middleton as well as perhaps others, for all we know, perhaps Sir William Strang, the head of the Foreign Office, why did they make McLean head of the American Department?
Because McLean had said he didn't want to serve abroad any longer, or for this posting. He'd done 6 years abroad, which is quite a long time, and that he'd rather be at home. And it was a senior job that was vacant, and they assumed he'd had whatever treatment he needed for whatever was wrong with him. And it was a job fitting his standing in the Foreign Office.
After McLean absconded with Burgess to Moscow, the Foreign Office stated, perhaps I'm not sure officially, but certainly unofficially, that the American Department was sort of a not very important department in the Foreign Office, mostly dealing with Latin America. In point of fact, isn't it correct that the American Department, at the very least, got copies of all of the major dispatches and diplomatic exchanges between the UK and the United States?
Absolutely. And there was a book published about the Foreign Office at the same time, much the same time, that states how important the American Department is to North American dealings as well as Latin America. And indeed, after McLean went, were found in his safe the documents to do with the Prime Minister Attlee going to visit Truman to persuade him not to use nuclear weapons, and which he'd threatened to. And so McLean saw those highly sensitive papers, and that was part of the Foreign Office sort of trying to lessen their culpability after McLean defected, was saying that.
When exactly was McLean finally identified as the most likely suspect of being the Russian spy Homer?
In the beginning of April 1951, when they decoded these words about his Melinda's pregnancy, that gave it away, and that's when they started following him, but not at evenings and weekends. And they were even so behaving in a very gentlemanly way. They couldn't actually have tried him in court without a confession, because the Venona operation was too highly classified, could never be brought up in court. So that was sort of why they're following him. But at the same time, they said they wouldn't be searching his home. Melinda was pregnant again. She was due to have a baby. She did have a baby in mid-June. And they said, well, we won't search his home till July, because it would be too unsettling for Melinda, first of all pregnant and then with a newborn. I mean, this extraordinary sort of lack of urgency continued, even when they knew he was a spy of such magnitude. They simply put watchers on him who were completely visible. A lot of his colleagues, and he indeed, as he was very tall, McLean, the watchers tend to be rather short. So several people noted that he had a sort of short man in a trilby hat and a raincoat puffing after him wherever he went in London. And so even when they knew in April they were watching him, but they were doing nothing to, they put telephone taps on his home telephone and his office phone, luckily for me. And but even so, they didn't display any desire to bring him in urgently at all. I think they were staving off the embarrassment that inevitably came when it was established that was their spy, and the public outcry that ensued, and mistrust of the people that ran Britain, that I think still lingers today, and not lingers, is still very evident today.
Now, the organization which was keeping McLean under surveillance was MI5 or Special Correct. Branch?
MI5, yes.
Now, how did McLean, of course, absconds with Guy Burgess, another one mm-hmm. of the Fabulous Five, in May 1951. How right. did McLean, and he ends up eventually in Moscow after first going to France, Switzerland, and then eventually Eastern Czechoslovakia, and then Moscow, and then someplace, I forgot the name of the city.
Kubishev. Kubishev, yes. Yeah.
He ends up there for a while. How did he adjust to life in Russia? Did he have difficulty in the transition the way that Burgess did?
No, I think he was quite the opposite of Burgess. Burgess, who hated being in Russia, he missed England, he missed the cricket, he missed the Times. He drank himself to death, effectively. McLean, on the other hand, got sober. I think the divide had gone that I talked about earlier. He got sober. He worked extremely hard in the profession he loved, which was foreign policy. He got a job in a foreign policy think tank, we call it today. He worked under an assumed name. This is after 1956, when he and Burgess reemerged. They were, nobody knew what had happened to them for 5 years, so we had a pretty good idea. He worked under an assumed name so as not to draw attention to the fact that he was a famous spy. He wrote a book that was published in Britain and America in 1970, was the first time he'd used his name, about British foreign policy since Suez, which was in 1956. So after he left, he was still involved in British foreign policy thinking. And he was slightly on the dissident wing of Soviet life. And I think he was content. And his letters home, of course, he knew they'd be opened by the Secret Services, but they paint a picture of life. His children and Melinda, which was a further terrible shock, defected in 1953 and joined him. And the children went to Soviet schools and pioneer camps and all that sort of thing. And it's a picture of a man undivided again.
Although Melinda, as well as I think all three children, eventually end up in the West by the time McLean passes away.
They do. Melinda, so the extraordinary thing about Melinda's time there is she left McLean to live with Philby, the sort of ultimate betrayal by Philby was to pinch McLean's wife for a few years. And then after that, they were really living separate lives, and she went back to America in 1979. Around that time, all three of his children and their wives and their own children left, which I think McLean, there's nothing I read that expresses McLean's sadness about that, but it must have never been sad, except the one, he gave one interview right at the end of his life, 5 days before he died, where it was published after he died, where he said he hoped his children were living the life they would have led had he not been a spy, which implies to me that he wasn't too unhappy that they left and felt that it was their right to live lives in Britain and America as their British and American parents might have done if he hadn't been a spy.
Finally, what is one to make of the career of Donald McLean? What should we take away from it today?
I think we should take away, when I was writing the book, I came rather to my surprise, I found his consistency and strength of his ideology in some ways admirable, that a man could who did believe in Britain could put himself and his family through such hell because of a belief in what his conscience told him. So I think that there's something, I mean, I don't want to overstate whether that's admirable or not, but there's something remarkable in it, perhaps, let's say. I think I take away the remarkable excitement in politics in the 1930s that perhaps we're now seeing again with the rise of populist movements as was happening then. But in between times, we didn't feel, we in the West, I don't believe, felt that excitement in politics. And I think I also take away that a man can work so hard for his country that he believes in, as well as betray it, seems to me an extraordinary feat.
I would like to thank you very much, Mr. Phillips, for being so kind to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. Thank you again, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you for having me on.